Who remembers which judge we studied our last time together on a Wednesday night? I think I heard someone. Yep, there you go. Samson. He's a pretty unforgettable guy, right? I'm guessing he has made you feel like an overachiever in your Christianity. Just studying his life has probably helped you to feel better about yourself. And that's a change of pace when you're studying the Word of God, isn't it? Usually when you're studying the men and the women of God in the Scriptures, you end up probably, more than likely, convicted. And that's because there are very few weaknesses to find among many of those Bible characters, and so many strengths. And with Samson, it was the opposite. He had a whole bunch of weaknesses, and really just one strength, which was his strength, his actual physical strength. And that was from the Holy Spirit. Now, does anyone know which judge is next on the list? Who comes after Samson? No. Good guess. That's a good guess based on the chapter we're staring down. I'll give you a hint. There are only two judges left. And the last one is Samuel. So the two that are left, that would be Eli is next. Eli. And then Samuel. But you'll notice those two characters, those two judges, are not found in the book of Judges, are they? Their stories, their accounts are given to us in the book of 1 Samuel. So, what do we do with the rest of the book of Judges? If we're through with the judges, we've still got five chapters left. What's this going to be about? Well, it is different. Chapter 17 through 21 is really its own little separate section here that you have to lift away from the chronology of the rest of the book. There are no more judges in the rest of these five chapters. And these last five chapters are not things that happen, quote unquote, after Samson. These are things that actually happen throughout the period of the judges. They are completely outside of the chronology of the book whatsoever. If I had to take a guess at this, I would take an educated guess and say that the things we're starting to study here, especially chapter 17, actually happened very early on, just a few generations down from Moses in the time period of the judges. I'll show you that in the passage tonight as we study down through this. Before the chapter's over, you'll understand why I arrive at that guesstimate. So we are given these additional five chapters at the end of the book of Judges, really just to make a single statement and then reinforce that statement with content. Now, that statement is given to us in Judges chapter 17, verse 6, excuse me, where it says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes," or in his own eyes. Now, we are given that same exact statement in chapter 21, verse 25, which is the very last verse in this book. And those two verses serve as the bookends for this final section here. You got the first one very early in this chapter, chapter 17, verse 6, and then the very last verse of this book. Those are the bookends, and they're to give us this statement that this was at a time period where everyone was just doing whatever it was that they wished. There was no ruling authority over them, with the exception of periods of time where God sent judges to deliver them and then essentially rule over them. But outside of that, it was pretty much anarchy, pretty chaotic and lawless throughout the land of Israel during that whole time period of the judges. So you might want to think of it this way, just kind of break the book in half right here. It's not really a perfect half, but you would have chapters 1 through 16, the record of the judges in chronological order, and then the second section of the book, chapters 17 through 21, which is a glimpse of just how bad things were in Israel during the time period of the judges, through the lens of some of Israel's lowest moments in their history. These are not good stories we're going to read. So if you looked at the beginning of the chapter and you saw the name Micah and you thought maybe this guy's a judge, you're going to find out, no, everything we're reading from chapter 17 through 21, these are things to learn from in the sense of, well, kind of like we've been learning from Samson. Here are some things not to do. That gives us an advance, some advance notice here. That's what we're looking for as we study this section. So let's begin it tonight by taking only chapter 17. It's a short chapter, and that's going to get us set in motion here for the final section of the book. Beginning in verse 1. There was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah, and his name means one who is like the Lord. But hold that thought. Verse 2. And he said to his mother, the 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, which would be an awful lot of money to have stolen from you. That's what he's talking about here. Theft. About which you uttered a curse and also spoke it in my ears. That is, Mom, I heard you speak that curse with my own ears. And he says, behold, the silver is with me. I took it. And his mother said, I am going to beat your bum red. No, that's what his mother should have said, but that's not what his mother did say. His mother said this, blessed be my son by the Lord. Now, probably not a single part of that story went the way that you were expecting any of it to go as you read through it. When you're reading the Bible and you come across a guy with a very spiritual name, what's the first thing you assume? You assume his parents are very spiritual people. And you assume you're going to be reading a story about a very spiritual family. But that's not what's happening here. We're not reading a story about a spiritual family that really loves the Lord and is really following the Lord. These aren't spiritual people at all. They are religious people. You're going to see before the chapter's out, they are very superstitious people, but they are not spiritual people. They are religious hypocrites at best. And as you'll see, it's even a little bit worse than that. In just the first two verses of this story, we found out that the mom has cursed and the son was a thief who stole from his own mom. And it's a story that you're really just thrown right into. We're just right into the fray here. There's no background. There's no setup. It's just, boom, here's a story. Lucky for us, it is super easy to figure out what's going on in this story. We correctly surmise that at some point in the past, his mother had 1,100 pieces of silver stolen from her. She did not know who stole it from her, but when she found out that it was stolen, she had uttered a curse on, you know, whoever it was that stole my money. Here's what I hope is going to happen to you. Now, some time has passed, and her son Micah is feeling guilty about this. And again, the chapter is going to reveal that he's a very superstitious guy, especially the last verse of this chapter. So it would seem in the chapter that his mother's curse has been eating him alive. Like wherever he looks in life, he just sees the curse. You know how that is. You know, the horse dies and the wagon breaks down. Oh, it's the curse. Or maybe the horse breaks down and the wagon dies. Oh, it's the curse. You know, I tripped over that rock and I broke my arm. There's the curse again. Everything bad that happens in this guy's life, he's got that curse from his mom in the back of his head. He heard her made that curse. He's been worrying about that for many years. It's been chasing him. He's seeing it in every shadow, and he just can't take that anymore. He can't take living like that, or so it would seem to me. He finally gets to the point where he wants to come clean. And so he says, Mom, yeah, you remember back when you had that 1,100 pieces of silver stolen from you? Yep, that was me. I was the one that took that. I'm the one that stole that from you. And that curse that I heard you say, it is beating me to death. So her response, if part of me wanted to say this isn't typical at all, but I guess maybe it is typical. her response, we'll just go with typical. She basically says, "Oh, honey, I did not know that was you. If I knew that was you that stole my money, I never would have uttered the curse. So I take it back and let me ask the Lord to bless you." So, you know, here she is praying this prayer. "Lord, bless my boy. He's really a good boy. I know he robbed his own mama blind, but he's got a good heart and he means well. So, Lord, could you bless him? If there's been a curse on him, lift the curse and bless him. He's my boy. Doesn't matter what he did. He can't do wrong in my eyes." I think we would all agree that it is always wrong for us as Christians to curse other people. Do you agree to that? I mean, I hope so, because it's a scripture. I would say it's a cluster of scriptures, but I just think automatically of Romans chapter 12, verse 14, where Paul tells us that we are to bless and not curse. Pretty straightforward. We have some other verses in the scriptures from Jesus himself, and, you know, we're told, don't curse those that curse you. Bless them. You bless those that curse you. So for a New Testament saint, it's never really appropriate for us to curse. It's good to remember that as you're reading through the scriptures, because you can come across some of the prophets and some of these men of God who had a call on their life and the Lord spoke to them. We're not always told that, but it has to be the case that the Lord spoke to them to utter a curse, and that was God's will. And so we can't be cursing people and justifying it by saying, "Well, prophet so-and-so from the Old Testament, he did it, so I'm going to do it." No, we're given New Testament doctrine plainly for us. We aren't to curse. And I think most Christians get that, and they're on board with that conceptually. And I do think that the reality of this slips by many Christians, that they are cursing and they don't even realize it. So I'm going to give you an example I gave you a long time ago, many, many years ago, just a few New Testament book studies ago, when we were going through Luke, the Gospel of Luke. I shared with you a little bit about cursing and how actually easy it is to do. I mean, it can happen very easily. Here's a good example for you. I like to use driving down the highway for many, many of my examples, because that's where I learn a lot about my own spirituality. And there you are, you're driving down the road, and you're driving 7 miles over the speed limit. Why? Well, peer pressure. You're trying to fit in with the other drivers on the road. And it doesn't work anyway, because you're still the slowest vehicle on the road. But here comes this guy, and he cuts you off, and he whips in front of you, almost causes you to run off the road and wreck your vehicle. And what do you do? What do you think to yourself? Well, you know, I should ask, what are you willing to admit that you think? If you think to yourself, "I hope that guy goes down the road and gets into an accident, serves him right. He needs to learn his lesson. At very least, I hope there's a cop up there waiting, and I hope he gets a ticket, because he's going like 30 miles over the speed limit." And you realize that's actually a curse? Oof. It's actually a curse. You say, well, aren't I just asking for justice? Isn't that a good thing, just to ask for justice? Well, I think the lady here in this story could make the same case. Just asking for justice here. Someone stole my money, and I want him to be caught. So that's all I'm asking for. Well, the Bible calls it a curse here. And if you think about it, it really kind of is. Because when it comes to matters of judgment, those are things we're supposed to keep our hands out of. When it comes to matters of justice, we're supposed to leave that to the Lord. So we really shouldn't be praying or thinking ill will upon other people. When we do that, technically, we're cursing. Now, we could talk about justifiable curses, but we won't go there tonight. That's outside the scope of this chapter of study. But I think there's a good lesson to learn here, that we be on guard for that. The issue is that whether we say it or not, if we're just thinking it, it all goes back to the heart thing. And this is what we've been learning a lot lately, that the law doesn't just govern the outwards and the words and actions, but it governs the internals too. You know, I have my own story with this. We just the other day got Rachel, my daughter's vehicle, finally repaired. I don't know if you knew what happened to her, but quite a while ago, almost a year ago, she was driving home from a very late shift, a midnight shift, and there was either a drunk driver or a high driver, and he just smacked into the back of her, ran up the side of her, run her off the road, and she was fine and all, but her vehicle was nearly totaled, like the whole side of it was just smashed up. And we were quoted a repair bill of $17,000. You know, they were saying, you might as well just total it. That's a lot of money. But I had a friend who could give me a better deal than that. So I said, well, if we cannot total it, that'd be great. And we'll try to repair it. And after that happened, I'm sitting there thinking about this. I'm like, here we are potentially having to pay for a $17,000 repair bill. And there's that guy, a hit-and-run driver that the cops can't find. All we really know is what color his vehicle was, because the paint's on my daughter's vehicle. And I thought to myself, I hope, Lord, that you might just dispatch a deer one of these times when he's driving. Because, Lord, you know there's plenty of them around here, more than there's ever been, so you have plenty of access. Just grab the closest one, Lord, and send that deer right out in front of that guy and square this up. And as soon as I thought that thought, I realized that was a curse. And I realized I can't be doing that. I can't be praying that way for that guy. Is that fair? Is that justice? Yeah, it is. But should I be praying that way? No. So what I did was I caught that thought, and by the time I went to the Lord in actual prayer, here's what I prayed. Lord, you deal with that guy. Whatever you want to do with that guy, that's your business. And Lord, please help us to figure out how to get this vehicle repaired. Now, if I just shared the end story with you, you'd be like, wow, our pastor is really astounding. What a very special guy, like just so solid and so spiritual. But I wanted to share the first part with you first because the curse was already there in my heart. I caught it before I prayed, but it was still there. And that's how easy it can happen for you as well. Any time, later on, if you're taking notes, write this down. Any time that you are wishing ill upon another person, what you are doing is you are wishing a curse upon them. And if you're speaking that to the Lord, then you're actually praying a curse upon them to the Lord. So just be very careful with that. Verse 3, and after confessing, he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. He paid her back. And his mother said, I dedicate the silver to the Lord. Notice Lord is in all caps. So she is using the name of Yahweh here, the covenant name of God. And the Hebrew also indicates that when she says, I dedicate the money, she's actually talking about all of the money. You can see this better in the King James Version, I believe it is. She's actually saying, I'm going to give every bit of this 1,100 pieces of silver. I'm going to dedicate it to the Lord. And watch how she dedicates this to the Lord. From my hand, for my son, to make a carved image and a metal image. Now, therefore, I will restore it to you. So this is a very confused family, right? They know the name of the Lord. They profess to be servants of Yahweh. They pray to the Lord. And the mother decides that she's going to rectify this whole situation. And the way that she's going to rectify it is by basically hiring with a certain amount of money, with all of it up front is what she says, all 1,100 pieces of this. I'm going to take this money and I'm going to hire someone to make a carved image, which is an idol made out of wood, sometimes plated with metal, sometimes not. But it's an idol that's carved out of wood. And then secondly, a metal image. So an idol made out of metal. That's how she wants to honor the Lord with this money. That's how she wants to try to reverse the curse that she had put on this money. Now, does anyone see a problem with her method? How about the second commandment, which says, Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 and 5, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them and serve them. So the heart of that commandment, of course, would be that we are to make no statues to worship as God. Now, God doesn't even want us to make a statue of what we think He looks like. Because in so doing, if we're making a statue of what we think the Lord looks like, or we're making a statue that we think captures some essence of God, inevitably what we're doing when we do that is we are falling so short of capturing the true essence of God that it is actually blasphemy. I think you could argue that when Aaron made gods, quote-unquote gods, for the people of Israel, that probably what they were thinking is, let's make a statue that really captures the essence of who Yahweh is. And they decided that was a cow, nurturing, life-giving. We can look at that and say, yeah, that's a really poor pick. But to them, that was what they thought. And we're doing the same thing. We're falling so short when we try to make some kind of statue that captures who God is. We're actually blaspheming the Lord. Well, and then on top of that, when we do that, when we make a statue of God or gods, we're taking our focus off of the one true God, and then we're putting that onto the statue that we made. We start rubbing it for good luck, and we start trusting it, and we start hoping in it. We're not even thinking of God. We've got the statue, and that has taken God's place. So it is always a diversion away from the true source and the true substance, and that is God Himself. Now, is it possible that this family just didn't know enough about the Word of God and the law of Moses? And that these were just sincere people and that they were doing the best they could with the knowledge that they had? Is that possible? Well, I don't think that's the case at all here. And I'm going to show you why I don't think that's true, especially once we get to verses 5 and 6. But first, let's take a look at verse 4. So then he restored the money to his mother. So when he restored the money to his mother took 200 pieces of silver. So she's already changed her mind about the amount. Truly, it is in the Hebrew. She was dedicating all of this money, all 1,100 pieces to the Lord. But by the time it comes to actually hire the workers to do the work, she's decided, you know what, 1,100, that's a lot of money. We could use that $900 for, you know, the savings fund, the retirement plan. I think 200 is plenty. She's come down on the price on what she's committed to the Lord. She's going to go with 200 pieces of silver now. So she took 200 pieces of silver and gave it to the silversmith, who made it into a carved image and a metal image. So a wooden idol, probably, since this is a silversmith, probably covered in silver, and then a metal idol. And it was in the house of Micah, verse 5. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod. What's an ephod? That's a priestly robe. And household gods. That's like the miniature versions that you can take and put home in the bedroom, that kind of thing. So he's making essentially a temple. And it says Micah ordained one of his sons who became his priest. So I just want to ask the question, who died and left this guy in charge of the tabernacle and the priesthood? Because that's what he's doing. He's starting his own thing here. If you go back through this carefully, this family has transgressed 6 of the 10 commandments in only 5 verses. Micah has coveted his mother's silver. That's the 10th commandment. He has stolen it. That's the 8th commandment. He has dishonored his mother. That's the 5th commandment. She had idols created for her son. That's the 2nd commandment. And they aren't serving the God they think they're serving. They're actually taking the name of the Lord upon themselves in vain. and yet it at the same time trying to turn God, Yahweh, into something that he is not. So they're making God out to be in whatever image they determine. So that is a violation of the first commandment and the third commandment. So that's commandments 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, and 10 that they broke in just five verses. That's batting 600. That's good if you're playing baseball. It's terrible if it's in the matters of transgressing the commandments. And again, we see what Micah is doing here. He's turning his own home into a replacement tabernacle. If you peek ahead to the last verse of the next chapter, chapter 18, verse 31, you'll see that the actual tabernacle of God was located in Shiloh this whole time. The tabernacle was there and it was functioning. And guess where Shiloh is? It's in Ephraim, which is where Micah and his family is from. The tabernacle is right there in their tribe, Shiloh. So this is not like a remote site for those days where, well, it's just too long of a drive to get to the tabernacle. Besides, you know, again, the horse broke down and the wagon died. So for those days, I need a remote location where I can worship the Lord. No, it's not an alternative remote site for when you can't make it to the sanctuary. This is a replacement for the tabernacle. It's an all-out replacement for the tabernacle. They want their own tabernacle because they are, as you're going to see, recreating and reworking the entire spiritual system that was given by God and handed down through Moses. So to answer the question, they definitely know better. They know full well what they're doing. I mean, if you know the ins and outs of sacrificial law and the priesthood and the tabernacle, if you know enough to have an ephod made, then I'm pretty sure you've probably heard about what preceded the law of Moses, the ceremonial and civil law, the Ten Commandments. Yeah, I'm pretty sure these folks would know about the Ten Commandments. So why not just go to the tabernacle? Well, probably, if we're looking at a character study of Micah, I would guess it's because he couldn't be in charge of it. He wants his own thing here. And if you can't make it exactly what you want it to be, then you want no part of it. You're just going to do your own thing. And I think that there's been plenty of Christians in the history of Christianity that didn't go to church for just that reason. Why won't you go to church? Because I can't control it. They won't let me control it. Would you believe they do stuff at that church that I don't like? I would want them to do completely different things in completely different ways. They don't do it to my taste, so I want no part of it. And most people don't start their own churches, which would be fine. You know, go do your own church in your own flavor, and maybe there's some other wackos out there like you that will join you. That's what I did here. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That slipped out. Sorry. But see, Micah, he is a little more motivated than most people. He's not just going to bow out of the whole thing and give up on it. No, he's going to start his own thing. For whatever the reason, he's starting his own religion, using the name of Yahweh, taking some of the concepts of the sacrificial system and the basic functionality of the tabernacle, but now he's going to make it his, and it's going to be in his own house. Verse 6. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So there's the first of the two bookends. This is all showing us the importance of worshiping God according to knowledge. And God sees and knows our hearts. I know that. I think we overuse that every time we do something wrong. Well, God knows my heart. Yes, he does. That should probably shouldn't be as comforting as you think it is. It's probably much worse than you realize it is. Yes, he does know our hearts. He knows when we're sincere and he knows when we're trying. All of that's true. But God is a defined God. He has defined himself for us in the Holy Scriptures. And he hasn't just defined himself and who he is, but he's also defined for us how we are to serve and even worship him. And it is important that we learn those things and then obey him. Isn't that why we're here twice a week, committing ourselves to those things? Christians are real quick to read Matthew chapter 11, verse 28 and love it. Matthew chapter 11, verse 28 is Jesus saying, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Yes, thank you, Lord. My religious endeavors are wearing me out. Trying to be holy, and it is beating me up. Thank you, Lord, for spiritual rest. But how many Christians really dig into the next verse and think about it? What's the next verse say? The next verse says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me." Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. So that means he's not saving us to do our own thing, to go our own way, to create our own religion. He's saving us so that we can learn the right way and then walk in the right way. There is one way. There's a whole bunch of wrong ways. There's one right way, and that is through Christ. That requires our engagement as we learn from him and then follow him. The people of Israel, during the time period of the judges, had no king, so they just did whatever they wanted to. Whatever seemed good, whatever floated their boat or struck their fancy, that's what they did. They were humanistic and hedonistic, just like unsaved America. But the Christian is not to be humanistic and hedonistic, following in their own way. The Christian is not kingless. That's the difference between us and Israel in this time period. We're not kingless. We have a king, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And he has a kingdom, and it's his, and it works one way. And we're to daily be praying to our king, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth," right here at Anchored Fellowship, right there in our respective homes, as it is in heaven. Verse 7. "Now there was a young man of Bethlehem in Judea." This is the location where our Lord Christ would eventually be born, Bethlehem of Judea, "of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there." Verse 8. "And the man departed from the town of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn, where he could find a place. And as he journeyed, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah." Now look real quick at Judges chapter 18, verse 30. I'm going to share this tonight and next week, but I'm sharing it tonight just in case I get a little wordy next week and don't have a whole lot of time for this. This is precautionary. If you have a King James Version or a New King James Version, there's a very definite error there. In Judges chapter 18, verse 30, the ESV corrects it and gets it right. It says this in the ESV: "And the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land." Now that verse is giving us the name of this Levite that we are studying in chapter 17. It says here that his name is Jonathan, and according to the ESV, he is the grandson of Moses. Now, if you look at this in the King James Version or the New King James Version, it says this is the grandson of Manasseh. Here's what you need to know. There's a one-letter difference between the name Manasseh, Moshe, and Manassas, and that is the Hebrew letter Nun. So the King James Version went with a manuscript that had a Nun there, and it read Manasseh. But if you look at Exodus chapter 22, verse 18, it tells us right there that Gershom is the son of Moses. And if you were with us as we studied through Exodus, you already knew that. Gershom is one of the sons of Moses. So this guy, Jonathan, this Levite, is a son of the son of Moses. He's the grandson of Moses. And by the way, this also gives us that timestamp that I was telling you about for this account. This Levite that we are studying in Judges chapter 17 is the grandson of Moses. So this story puts us just two generations after the life of Moses. So it did not happen after Samson. This story is not chronological. It actually happened very early on in the early stages of the time period of the Judges. Verse 9. And Micah said to him, to Jonathan, the grandson of Moses, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I am a Levite." Indeed, he was. He was a grandson of Moses. "I am a Levite of Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to sojourn where I may find a place." I'm looking for a fresh start. I needed to get away from the pressure cooker that is tabernacle worship in Shiloh. It's just so by the book there. Looking for a place that's a little more relaxed. Looking for a new line of work, maybe. And I know I'm putting some words in the guy's mouth here, but I don't think I'm going to end up being very far off at all. Because this guy is a Levite. He has a rightful claim to be a worker in the tabernacle at Shiloh, but instead he's searching for something else. The only way I could see this as not being this Levite's fault, is if this had something to do with there being a whole lot more families like Micah's that weren't going to the tabernacle, that weren't bringing their sacrifices, that weren't giving their offerings. And if that was happening on a widespread scale throughout the nation of Israel, then what's going to happen to the tabernacle? The tabernacle is going to be undermanned. It's going to function at a much less capable ability because the finances aren't there. It's not being supported. It's the same way with Christian ministry. If the people aren't coming to church, if they're doing their own thing, well, then sometimes ministry gets to the point where ministry has to go and look for other work. So if it's a reason like that, that this guy's out sojourning around, leaving home, deserting on the tabernacle to go find some other lifestyle or some other line of work, then fine, not his fault. But for any other reason, these would be negative things that are driving him to do this. To not want to serve as a tabernacle worker, and instead to be looking for something else to do with his life. Verse 10, and Micah said to him, "Stay with me and be to me a father and a priest." So first things first here, Micah asks Jonathan to be a father to him. Now, here's a good question. What exactly is he asking? Is he asking Jonathan to be a father figure to him? I know that sounds kind of strange because Micah is older at this point. Jonathan is a young man. And if that's what he's asking, if he's asking this young man to be a father figure for him, maybe based on the fact that, well, he's a Levite. He's a spiritual guy. If he's doing that, I just want to tell you right off the bat, that's not what ends up happening. If you look at the end of verse 11, you'll see the exact opposite happens. Jonathan does not become a father figure for Micah, but instead Micah becomes a father figure for this guy, this Levite, Jonathan. The other possibility, and I think this is maybe the correct one, would be that this is the first time in Scripture that we're seeing the word father being used as a religious title. And if that is the case, if this is being used as a religious title, you know how the Lord feels about this. You know that the Lord has spoken about that condemningly in Matthew chapter 23, verse 9, where Jesus told us, "Call no man on earth your father, for you have one Father who is in heaven." And he, of course, was speaking about using that word Father as a religious title. He gave us a few others there, too. In the ESV, it's Rabbi and Instructor. So we have to be careful with religious titles. It was funny tonight. Walked past Jerry and he said, "Arlen," and he said, "No, I mean pastor." And I said, "Nope, Arlen." I like that. We don't need religious titles. If you give them to honor, that's fine. We do read that elders are worthy of honor, and those that labor in the word are worthy of double honor. I don't want to just always deny that or reject that. If you choose to use titles like that to show respect, fine. But the person shouldn't be pushing for his title, for sure. I think we talked about this before. Aren't you glad I don't expect you to call me Father Arlen? Wouldn't that be weird, especially for my dad? Now, we don't need religious titles. We're brothers and sisters. We have different parts in the body, but we're brothers and sisters. So either way, I think the request is odd. Be to me a father. But then he also says, be to me a priest. Micah asked Jonathan to serve as his personal priest. And Jonathan is actually not qualified to be a legitimate Levitical priest. The way this worked, and some of you folks know this, you've been with us through Exodus and Leviticus. You know, the way this worked was that if you were from the tribe of Levi, you were qualified to be a tabernacle worker, or later on in the fixed form of the temple. You could be a worker. You could do odds and ends. You could get things ready. You could carry things. You had roles that you could do as the temple worker. But to be a priest in the tabernacle, you had to be from a specific family that came from the tribe of Levi. Does anyone remember what that family is? It's the family of Aaron, the brother of Moses. And who's this guy from? Moses. So it's a big deal. I mean, my goodness. Talk about street cred. Who's your granddad? Moshe. Moses, the lawgiver. That's pretty good street cred. I'll give him that. But he is not qualified to serve as a priest. And maybe that was part of the motivation here for Jonathan to accept this position and serve as a priest. Maybe he's thinking to himself, well, all I could ever be in the tabernacle was a worker, you know, a ministry grunt. But this guy, Micah, he wants to hire me as a priest. Sure, it's a make-believe tabernacle. Sure, it's a make-believe position, but I'll have the title of priest. And I'll have people call me Father. Father Jonathan. Well, this guy, for sure, is a hireling. And Jesus had some condemning things to say about hirelings, too, didn't he? This is in John chapter 10. Yeah, we're not to be hirelings. Hired to do as if it's a job, a secular job to do. All right, you know, you pay me so much for 2 sermons a week, and that's what you're getting. And the rest of the week, you'll find me at the bar. But I'll do, don't worry, I'll do my job when I'm here. I'll be spiritual when I'm here. Now, we don't need hirelings. We need people that the Lord has called shepherds after God's own heart. In this case, what we needed is, well, the real tabernacle and bona fide priest from the actual priesthood. I don't know what this means for Micah's son, because remember, Micah had appointed his son as the priest over the shrine, this fake replacement tabernacle. He made his son the priest of the family and whatever it is that they're creating here in this shrine. But now it's like, well, sorry, son, I found myself an actual Levite. You know how close that is to a bona fide priest? I had to hire the guy, so sorry, son, you're out. Find something else to do. Muck the barns, you know, whatever. But Maybe he fired his son. Maybe he had two priests. I don't know. But regardless, none of this matters because all of it is illegitimate. I mean, the whole thing is illegitimate. Verse 10, reading on. And I will give to you 10 pieces of silver a year and a suit of clothes and your living. And the Levite, Jonathan, went in, verse 11. And the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. So that was the deal there. Jonathan takes the job for 10 pieces of silver a year, which is a horrible salary. Some new threads, like a whole change of clothes. Wow, big deal. And then paid living expenses. So Micah essentially says, you can live with me, and that's free room. That's free board, that's free meals, paid living. So, just get this. I mean, let this sink in. This Levite, Jonathan, one of the very grandsons of Moses, is completely content with this lowball offer. He thinks it's a good deal. Listen, it is not a good deal. This is pitiful, and this is ridiculous. He has sold out on the Lord for a very low price. And I guess this would be a good time to ask me, for me to ask you, pardon me, do you have a price? Would you sell out on the Lord? And if so, what's your price? You know, this is a legitimate thing. This happens all the time. You know how many Hollywood actors and Nashville singers that I have listened to in interviews actually admit that they have sold their soul to the devil for money and fame? This happens all of the time. It really does. But when you do that, what are you profiting, even if you would gain the whole world and in the process forfeit your soul? That's what Jesus told us in Mark chapter 8, verse 36. So I'm asking you if you have a price, because you do need to know if you have a price. If you have a price, there's a really good chance that the enemy is going to start bringing some offers your way. If you have a price, he's going to know it, and he's going to make you the offer. And when he makes you the offer, if that's your asking price, well, then you're gone and we lose you, because you sold out on the Lord for whatever it is that you sold out on the Lord for. Esau did it for a bowl of soup. What's your price? I say, by the grace of God, I have no price. You agree? Are you the same? You have no price. Is there anything that Satan or the world could offer you that would cause you to forfeit your soul and say, yes, I'll take that? Money? Are you kidding me? Look at that salary. Yes. Fame? Oh, it's what I've always wanted. Yes, I'm in. You can have my soul. I'll be eternally damned just for like 20, 30, 40 years of like really good living on the earth. That's insane. Talk about reckless and careless. I hope you're like me. I believe with all my heart I have no price. I do not want fame. I don't even like to get up here in front of you all. It makes me nervous, especially when you sit there and stare at me like you're doing right now. I don't want fame, money, neither here nor there. Don't care. I'm more than content with my wife. You know that. You read my Facebook post, right? That woman's perfect. So I'd be ridiculous to be wanting anything else there. I really believe by the grace of God, I don't have a price, and I hope you're the same way. I believe you are. No matter what Satan offers, who cares? Get bent, man. We're content. We're staying put right where we are. We are the Lord's. We are destined for heaven, and there's nothing that's going to sidetrack us from that. Verse 12, and Micah ordained the Levite, and the young man became his priest and was in the house of Micah. So who was it that ordained the Old Testament priest? Does anyone remember from Exodus, Leviticus? It was Moses. Now, Moses wasn't a priest, but God called Moses as the prophet, the deliverer. He was the, you know, he was the type of God himself for the nation, and God chose for Moses to ordain Aaron, his brother, as the high priest, and then Aaron's sons as the priests. So why is this Micah guy, who is not from the tribe of Levi at all, so he's definitely not from the family of Aaron, he's like nowhere close to any of that as far as his lineage is concerned. He's definitely not a prophet, so who does this guy think he is to be ordaining Levitical priests and starting his own tabernacle? Again, doesn't matter. All of this is just useless anyway. Sorry, not sorry. It's like being baptized by a practicing lesbian priest. Illegitimate is illegitimate. What's not recognized by God and honored by God is never going to be recognized and honored by God. There's a right way to do things in His kingdom and in His work. And anything outside of that, He's not going to wink at it and say, close enough, I know your hearts. You're good people. Verse 13. Then Micah said, now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as priest. So you can see, I think, right from this verse, can't you see it? This guy still has the curse mentality. Like, even though his mom has tried to lift the curse and counter it with a blessing, it seems to me he still has the curse mentality. He wants to be blessed by God, not to the extent that he would do things God's way. He's still going to find his own way and be his own man. But he's still running, I think, from that curse. And he thinks, this is it. I've finally done it. I'm finally going to break the curse here. I'm finally going to win God's blessings. I'm finally going to get God's favor. Because look how spiritual I am. I built my own tabernacle. I got my own system going here. I made an ephod. I've got a priest. I mean, he's not a real priest, but he's a Levite. How close is that? I mean, I'm like, I've got to be blessing the Lord right now. I've got to be winning the Lord's favor here. So what is this guy really doing? Well, he's being disobedient to the law of Moses. He's out on his own limb, and he's out of his own gourd. He's doing the wrong things. And to get to the very bottom of this, what he's trying to do is he's trying to win the favor and the blessing of God through his religious works. And what does the Bible teach us about? How do you get the favor of God? How do you get the favor of God? Faith. And it's grace in the New Testament because of that. It's God's favor that is undeserved, unearned, unmerited. We get it because of our faith in Him. And how do we get His blessing? Through obedience. And those are two things this guy just knows nothing about. All right, folks, stand and we're going to close in a word of prayer and continue on. We're not done with Micah. We'll talk about him next week. He's like a linchpin for all of this, or a launch pad for much of what happens in the remaining section of this book. So we're going to be talking about him next week as well. Let's close in prayer.